The first thing is, I don't speak Spanish, and I don't know that any of you here do. There is the difficulty about Spanish names. Some Spanish sounds are rather different from, well, the way of using letters is different from what we are used to. But I will pronounce the names in an English sort of way. And to help you with unfamiliar names, I have distributed a sheet where the more significant names have been listed in the order to which I will refer to them.
Are any more copies of the sheet?
No, I'm sorry. But perhaps you can share with a neighbour if necessary. I haven't listed everybody on the sheet, but those that are referred to more than once, I have listed them. Well then, to come to the paper. There is no country in Europe whose history is so tragic as that of Spain. So J.A. Wiley declared, in Spain, he pointed out, the reformers had to encounter unaided the whole power of Philip II, pushed on by the Pope. Yet the Spanish Church had already undergone a reformation, albeit one that was purely moral. Queen Isabella was concerned to cleanse the church in her realms, and Cardinal Ximenes was placed in charge of the operation. For instance, he went round the monasteries and insisted on the strictest discipline, but something far more was needed. On the 31st of October 1517, Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses to the door of the Wittenberg Church, a date which marks the beginning of the Reformation. In early 1519, a set of tracts by Luther in Latin appeared in Spain, printed in Basel. The next year, Luther's commentary on Galatians was translated into Spanish. It contains his teachings on justification by faith alone. This was followed by other translations, including his Bondage of the Will, written in opposition to a volume on free will by Erasmus, the Dutch theologian. Though Erasmus wrote against the defects in Roman Catholic practice, he never left the church and did not give up Rome's distinctive doctrines. These translations were probably made in Antwerp. The cost was borne by Spanish merchants there. They would have sent such literature to Spain along with other goods. In 1521, the Pope, Leo X, directed the civil authorities in Spain to prevent Luther's books entering the country. At this point, the Inquisition there was more focused on the writings of Erasmus. Indeed, Erasmus' writings had a greater circulation in Spain than in any other European country. Alfonso Valdez was a young, able Spaniard who had been a secretary to Charles V. Peter Martyr, an Italian reformer, employed Valdez in 1520 to translate into Spanish an account of the Reformation in Germany. Valdez, though recognizing defects in the Roman system, was still entangled with it, for he thus refers to the Pope. While he tenaciously adheres to his rights, and shutting his ears under the influence of a pious feeling perhaps, wishes to have Luther devoted to the flames, the whole Christian Commonwealth is going to ruin. When Charles V appeared at the Diet of Augsburg in 1530 to settle the religious affairs of his German empire, Valdez met Philip Melanchthon. Melanchthon expressed disappointment about the strong Spanish prejudices against the reformers. Valdez acknowledged it was commonly believed in Spain that Luther and his followers did not believe in God, the Trinity, but in Christ. Valdez actually read the Augsburg Confession before it was presented to the Diet. His only objection apparently was that the language used against its opponents was rather severe. But when he returned to Spain, he was accused to the Inquisition and condemned as a suspected Lutheran. Among Valdez's friends was Alfonso de Vivres, a learned Benedictine monk who was Charles V's chaplain. The chaplain, however, was known to appreciate, to some extent, the writings of Erasmus. He was also known to have conversed with some of the reformers. This was enough to attract the suspicions of the Inquisition in Seville, in southern Spain. He was arrested, and nothing he could do could release him from the ruthless power of the Inquisition. He pointed out that he had written against Melanchthon, but in vain. The king tried to stop the Inquisition pursuing his favourite preacher, but this too was unsuccessful. De Vivres spent 4 years in prison before he was condemned as suspected of holding Lutheran views. He was sentenced to make a formal abjuration of Luther's doctrines in general, and in particular of the errors he was suspected of holding. It shows the huge power of the Inquisition when it could so act in the face of the king's wishes. Now, the Inquisition was not a new institution in response to the Reformation. It was established in 1478 to root out Jews and Moors who professed to be Roman Catholics, but were suspected of secretly practicing their former religion. It has been described as the most efficient instrument for the suppression of dissent yet developed. According to McCree, the first person in Spain to embrace the Reformation faith and become active in spreading it was Juan Valdez. He had a university education and held a position at court. In 1535, he was sent to Naples, part of Charles V's dominions, as a secretary to the viceroy. Before leaving Spain, he wrote Advice on the Interpreters of Sacred Scriptures. Valdez originally sent this as a letter to his friend Bartolome Carranza, later Archbishop of Toledo. It contained the following statements. 1. In order to understand the sacred scriptures, we must not rely on the interpretations of the fathers. 2. We are justified by a lively faith in the passion and death of our Savior. 3. Thus we may attain to a certainty concerning our justification. The Inquisition already had suspicions about Carranza's orthodoxy, but when he was arrested, Valdez's letter was discovered and formed one of the most serious pieces of evidence against him. Carranza acted inconsistently at times, but spent 17 years in prison and died there. Valdez's contribution to the Spanish Reformation continued from outside the country through his writings, which included a commentary on Romans. One who did much to advance God's work within Spain was Rodrigo de Valer. a fashionable young man living in Seville. His time was originally taken up with sport and entertainment. Suddenly, he shut himself up in his room and gave himself to reading and meditating on religion. People assumed he was mentally disturbed. He had already learned a little Latin. Now he applied himself with great diligence to the language so that he could read the Vulgate, the only version of the Bible permitted in Spain. In a remarkably short time, he could quote almost any passage, from memory and expound it. His system of doctrine was substantially Lutheran. When Valère was satisfied he had learned the truths of Revelation, he appeared again in public. With the Bible as his supreme standard, he argued against priests and monks. If he could not persuade them, he reproved them for their errors. Valère did have some success, but most of those he accosted rejected his efforts. What right had he to instruct his teachers? In response, he claimed to have learned not from the polluted streams of tradition and human invention, but from the pure fountain of revealed truth through the teaching of the Spirit. Valère was soon hauled before the inquisitors, with whom he disputed on such subjects as justification, the church, and its distinctive marks. Some who had secretly accepted his teachings did their best to have him released. Their influence, his high rank in society, and the belief that he was insane led to more lenient treatment than normal. His property was confiscated, but he was released. His friends persuaded him to lie low, and he confined himself to expounding Romans to them privately. But his zeal could not be restrained for long. He hoped that, though he might lose his life, others would follow him, and so the truth might gain the victory. He was again brought before the Inquisition and condemned to life imprisonment. The most distinguished of Valère's converts is usually known as Dr. Egidius. He became a professor of theology and was then unanimously elected a preacher in Seville Cathedral. But he was not successful in this position and was ready to resign when Valère sought him out and gave him good advice. Instead of the dry discussions of the past, he now appealed powerfully to his hearers, and conversions resulted. These converts were strengthened through Egidius' continued preaching, so that when called to face death because of their faith, they were able to do so joyfully. Two others who profited from contact with Egidius were Dr. Vargas and Constantine Ponce de la Fuente. They cooperated in trying to spread the gospel. Vargas lectured to the more educated. His lectures including expositions of Romans and the Psalms. Constantine sometimes assisted Egidius in preaching. Their zeal aroused suspicion, but it also provoked hardline Romanists to greater diligence in promoting their superstitions. Those in Seville whose allegiance was to the Bible were growing in number, and small groups of believers were planted in surrounding districts. The Inquisition was watching, but perhaps because of the popularity of Egidius, they hesitated to act. Meanwhile, Vargas died, and Constantine was sent to the Netherlands with Philip, the heir to the throne. In 1550, the king nominated Egidius to one of the richest bishoprics in Spain. Now the Inquisition pounced. They charged Egidius with heresy and sent him to a secret prison. He was charged with errors on justification, human merit, assurance, purgatory, and confession. In his defense, he produced a statement of his views on justification, but it simply supplied the prosecutor with further evidence. The king wrote in support of Egidius, as did colleagues in Seville. But in 1552, he was condemned to 3 years' imprisonment, and he must abjure the propositions for which he was condemned. He appeared among those condemned to do penance at an auto da fe, which is literally an act of faith. This was a ritual of public penance by condemned heretics. Others might be burnt to death. Presumably, Egidius submitted to the penance. He certainly felt extremely discouraged after the trial as a result of a friend's unfaithfulness. In 1555, he was released, and the next year he visited Valladolid in northern Spain, where he found several who had embraced Reformed doctrine. He felt revived in his spirit through his time with them and exhorted them to constancy in the faith. But soon after leaving them, he took ill and died. The inquisitors decided that he had died in the Lutheran faith and ordered his remains to be disinterred and burnt. His property was confiscated and his memory declared infamous. But how had the Reformation faith taken hold in Valladolid? A merchant, Francisco San Roman, had spent time in the Netherlands, then including Belgium. In 1540, his employer sent him from Antwerp to Bremen on business. San Roman was anxious to learn about the religion so strongly condemned in his own country. He went to church, and the sermon made a great impression on him. He sought out the preacher privately and profited greatly from his contacts with Protestants. Naively, San Roman thought he could persuade others of the truths now so clear to himself. So he is extremely anxious to return to Spain to spread the true religion. San Roman's letters back to his employers included references to his new faith. So, on his return to Antwerp, a group of friars were waiting for him, and he was arrested. After months of severe confinement, he was released. Some of his friends claimed his zeal had cooled. A friend urged him to be cautious in speaking to people, but his caution was short-lived. San Roman went to Ratisbon, where a diet of the Roman Empire was sitting. He was elated to hear that the emperor was showing favor to the Protestants, though this was only for political reasons. He managed to meet the emperor, but when he sought a second meeting, some courtiers would have thrown San Roman into the Danube. But Charles insisted that he be sent to Spain. Brought to trial in 1544, he freely confessed the great Reformation doctrine that salvation is not by human merit, but only from God's mercy through the sacrifice of the one mediator. And he declared that the Mass, confession, purgatory, prayers to the saints, and the worship of images are blasphemy. San Roman endured a long imprisonment with patience. He resisted all the friars' efforts to make him recant. After the fire was lit, the friars understood a movement of his head to mean that he now wished to recant, and they had him brought from the fire. San Roman looked them calmly in the face and asked, "Do you envy my happiness?" He was at once thrown back in the flames and expired soon afterwards. His firmness made a strong impression on the spectators and strengthened some Protestants. Within a few years, they formed themselves into a church and met regularly in private for worship. Among the positive influences on Spain were the efforts of Jaime Enzias, one of three brothers who left Spain to study in Louvain. While in Paris, he was influenced by the heroism of Protestant martyrs. He drew up a Protestant catechism and had it printed in Antwerp. In Rome, he was denounced to the Inquisition and sentenced to death by burning. He remained faithful to death, which was in 1546. Another brother, Francisco, translated the New Testament into Spanish, unaware that there had been previous translations. It was printed in Antwerp in 1543. Charles V arrived in Brussels soon afterwards, and a copy was presented to him, asking permission for it to be circulated in Spain. He agreed, provided nothing contrary to the faith was found in it. But in the end, Francisco Enzias was accused of being an enemy of religion and was thrown into prison. He was charged with the offence of translating the scriptures and a book by Luther. Francisco spent his time in prison translating the Psalms. But after spending 15 months in prison, he one day found the doors open, walked out, and escaped to Germany. Others in exile produced works for Spanish readers. Roman Catholic theologians in Spain, however, were particularly vociferous in opposing translations of the scriptures. One claimed that this is the true fountain of all heresies. One who brought books from Geneva to Spain in 1557 was Julian Fernandez, a Spanish national, an unusually small man. He put them in two large casks and brought them to Seville, from where they were distributed to various parts of the country. The condemnation and weakening of Egidius was a severe blow to the infant church in Seville. Though he was released from custody, the restrictions placed on him and his low spirits limited his effectiveness. Shortly before Egidius' death, Constantine Ponce de la Fuente returned to Seville in 1555, which was a major boost to the Protestant cause there. In Germany, his views of scriptural doctrine had been enlarged. McCree describes him as unquestionably the greatest ornament of the Reformed cause in Spain. He was appointed a professor of divinity in the College of Doctrine, and through his lectures on the scriptures, many young men were brought to believe the truth. He was also chosen to be a preacher in the cathedral. Although the service would not begin until 8 a.m., the building was full by 4 o'clock when he was to preach. He also tried to spread the truth through the printed page, always seeking to meet the spiritual needs of the people in a style that the least educated could follow. His objective was not to teach distinctly Protestant doctrine, but to present the basic truths of the gospel. Yet his writing was viewed with great suspicion because he had not condemned what were considered Lutheran errors. He had not defended the supremacy of the Pope, If he mentioned purgatory, indulgences, and human merit, it was to warn people not to rest on them for salvation. Constantine went free after saying he would handle these subjects in his second volume. Francisco Zafra was a priest in Seville with secret Lutheran leanings. Recognized as a learned man, he had often to advise the Inquisition on charges laid against individuals, and was often the means of rescuing those who would have been condemned as heretics. He received into his house a widow, Maria Gomez, who attended secret Protestant meetings. In 1555, she became deranged and went to tell the Inquisition that the city was full of Lutherans while they were sleeping at their post. She named over 300 as Lutherans. The inquisitors were aware that Lutheranism was rife, yet realized that Maria was mentally disturbed. But they followed their rigid principle that no accusation was to be disregarded. Zafra was summoned and emphasized Maria's state of mind, so he was allowed to go free. God, in his providence, was watching over his flock, who may not yet have been mature enough to endure persecution. If Zafra had then been condemned, it is likely that many more would have been caught in the Inquisition's net. The Protestants of Seville were now organized as a congregation and appointed a pastor. They met in the home of a rich lady from the nobility. Another of high rank was Domingo de Guzman, who had an extensive library which included the main Lutheran volumes. These he readily shared with others. The new doctrines also spread into most of the monasteries and convents around Seville. Garcia de Arias was sympathetic to the new teachings, but extremely cautious, and even prepared to speak in support of Roman doctrines. Yet God used him to bring the truth to the monks in the monastery of San Isidro, near Seville, who were steeped in deepest ignorance. Although speaking cautiously, Arias taught that true religion did not consist in outward action. People needed to go to the Bible to know God's mind. His words left the monks dissatisfied with their monotonous devotions. But Arius turned around and began to promote the strictest forms of bodily mortification, like sleeping on bare earth during Lent. This produced a reaction among the monks. They decided they would be wiser to listen to Egidius and his friends. Later, the monks received a supply of Bibles and Protestant books and read them eagerly. Prayers for the dead were dropped. Indulgences, which had provided a considerable income, were abolished. But images remained, though they were no longer worshipped. And, most seriously, the Mass was still said. Though speaking to people outside the monastery, through speaking to people outside the monastery and circulating good literature, the monks spread the Reformation faith over a wide area, including other religious houses. Yet some who advanced some distance in a Protestant direction turned back. Among them was Juan de Regla, the head of the Order of St. Jerome in Spain. He was reported to the Inquisition, who condemned him to do penance and repudiate 18 statements with a Lutheran flavour. He did so, and ever after was a most bitter persecutor of those suspected of Protestant sympathies. The Protestants in Valladolid chose Domingo de Roxas as their pastor. He was an able man who had been educated under Bartolome Carranza. But, says McCree, the disciple did not confine himself to the timid course of his master. Roxas boldly repudiated, among other teachings, purgatory and the Mass. Through his zealous efforts, many joined his congregation. Among them was Augustine Cazalla, considered one of the ablest pulpit orators. He had traveled to Germany in 1546 as a chaplain to Charles V. There he was tasked with opposing the Lutherans, but instead he embraced the doctrines of the Reformation. Although he continued a royal preacher, his real beliefs were discerned by his more observant hearers. Yet, because of his reputation, he was not charged with heresy. After Cazalla settled in Valladolid, the Protestant church normally met in his mother's home. He was persuaded to take charge of its spiritual interests. Indeed, the Reformation spread through much of the country. Perhaps it was because many of them were learned or belonged to the higher echelons of society that over 2,000 widely scattered people were able to maintain loose contact and keep meeting in private without being detected by the Inquisition. Yet the slightest public expression of support for biblical teaching was likely to be immediately suppressed by that ruthless and powerful body. Humanly speaking, McCree believes, had this obstacle been removed from Spain, though only in part and for a short time, it would have burst into a flame, which resistance would only have increased, and which, spreading over the peninsula, would have consumed the Inquisition, the hierarchy, and the papacy. Some Protestants left Spain to find freedom in other states, including Geneva and Germany. Clergy in the Brussels court of Philip II kept a close watch on refugees from Spain. Philip succeeded to the throne when his father, Charles V, abdicated in 1554, and he was the husband of Queen Mary of England. From their spies, these clerics learned late in 1557 that a large number of Protestant books had entered Spain and that heresy was spreading quickly. The inquisitors soon discovered that Julian Hernandez had been involved and threw him in prison. He was ready to confess his views. He was glad to have helped to make the scriptures available in Spain. His superior knowledge of the Bible made him victorious in all his debates, even with educated men, and he was no scholar. The inquisitors were anxious to obtain information from Hernandez about his fellow Protestants. They hoped thus, in their own words, at once to crash the viper's nest. During the 3 years Hernandez was kept in prison, he was frequently tortured in horrific ways, but gave nothing away. In Seville and the surrounding area, 200 Protestants were arrested in one day. Not all of them could have resisted the inquisitor's questioning as Hernandez did, for the number arrested there soon reached 800. In Valladolid, 80 were imprisoned, and the Inquisition was similarly active in other parts of Spain. So many were arrested that it was difficult to find space for them all. Zafra was one of those who escaped in the confusion and fled to Germany. Reference has already been made to the monks of San Isidro, who went some way in adopting Protestant principles. Later, 12 of them left, and following different routes for safety, met as planned in Geneva a year later. The storm of persecution burst just a few days later and caught up the monks who remained behind, as well as various contacts. One of these refugees from the San Isidro Monastery, Casadora de Reina, was responsible for the first complete Spanish Bible, which was printed in Basel in 1569. After Charles V's death, persecution intensified. Philip decreed that those who possessed any book forbidden by the Inquisition would suffer capital punishment and have their goods confiscated. He also renewed a statute which entitled informers to receive a quarter of the property of those found guilty of heresy. Such legislation must have encouraged many false accusations from those who might receive a significant boost to their property. Further, those convicted of believing Luther's doctrines, even if they recanted, were subject to capital punishment. Suspected Protestants suffered prolonged imprisonment, most for 2 years, many for three, during which they were examined endlessly. The inquisitors might assure them one day that they would escape further punishment if they made an honest confession of all they knew. The next day, they would be told that their confessions had only served to confirm the inquisitors' suspicions of their sincerity. Intense pressure was applied to extract a recantation so that it could be read at the auto-da-fé. The effort to persuade prisoners to recant was a cruel deceit. They were likely to be killed anyway. Constantine Ponce de la Fuente was regarded as the ablest of those who promulgated the new doctrines. Though one of Charles V's chaplains, he was among the first to be arrested in Seville. He denied the charges against him, and the inquisitors almost despaired of convicting him, but he was doomed when part of his library was fortuitously discovered. Various volumes were deemed heretical, but most significant was a book in his own handwriting. In it he discussed the true church and the principles of Luther and Calvin, and showed that the papal church had no claim to the title. Similarly, he discussed other doctrines, justification, good works, the sacraments, indulgences, and purgatory. He called this last an invention of the monks to feed idle bellies. Constantine acknowledged that the book contained his beliefs, but nothing could persuade him to inform on any Protestant. For some reason, the inquisitors did not subject him to torture, possibly because Charles had such high respect for him. Shortly after Charles' death, Constantine was removed to a damp and pleasant dungeon. There he cried out, "O my God, were there no Scythians or cannibals or pagans still more savage, that thou hast permitted me to fall into the hands of these baptized fiends?" He contracted dysentery and soon died. But his death did not satisfy the Inquisition. At an auto-da-fé in December 1560, his effigy and bones were displayed so that he could be publicly condemned. 2 years after the initial flurry of arrests, these cases came to a conclusion. Autos-da-fé were held throughout the land, but most victims were in Seville and Valladolid, the main centres of Protestant activity. All the clergy and civil authorities had to attend, and to maximize the size of the crowd, a 40-day indulgence was granted to all who came. All the spectators were obliged to take an oath binding them to live and die in communion with Rome and to uphold the Inquisition against all adversaries. The previous evening, prisoners who were penitent and were to suffer a punishment less than death were informed of their sentence. At midnight, a confessor came to each of the prisoners who were to be brought to the stake. He earnestly exhorted them to die reconciled to the Church. Yet the only advantage of recanting at that stage was a quick death. The prisoner would be strangled before being burnt. Proceedings began with a sermon. Then the sentences of the penitents were read, and on their knees they repeated their confession. Punishments could include banishment, whipping, hard labour, and imprisonment. Those condemned to death were handed over to the secular authorities to be put to death. At every auto da fe, the inquisitors obliged the magistrates to swear that they would faithfully execute the sentences passed against the heretics without delay. The inquisitors directed the state officials to treat them with compassion. A compassionate burning is somewhat hard to understand, but the Inquisition was a thoroughly cynical system. The first auto da fe for burning Protestants took place in Valladolid in May 1559. A huge crowd attended, including the heir to the Spanish throne. 30 prisoners were brought out. 16 were reconciled to Rome, 2 were burnt alive, and the other 14 were strangled first. The number who recanted may seem large. Yet most of them would have been babes of the flock, if indeed they were truly converted. We know little about them and the pressures they were under. Among those sentenced to death was Casala, pastor of the Seville congregation. When about to be tortured, his courage failed. He confessed he had embraced Lutheran doctrine, but said he had only taught it to those who already believed it. A monk informed him of his sentence and said, perhaps dishonestly, that he might be shown mercy if he confessed everything that witnesses had said against him. It was then clear to Casala that his fate was sealed. He replied, well then, I must prepare to die in the grace of God, but it is impossible for me to add to what I have said without falsehood. He was duly burnt after being strangled. One of the two who were burnt alive was an advocate, Antonio Herezulo, who remained unbroken in spirit throughout the fearful experience of torture and burning. But what moved him was to see his wife dressed as a penitent. The look he gave her as he passed to go to the place of execution seemed to say, this is hard to bear. She never forgot that look. She was only 22, and may well have been told that her husband had recanted. Such was the gross dishonesty of the Inquisition. In common with many others who were arrested, she had little opportunity to become established in the faith. Yet she soon resolved, in dependence and divine strength, to follow her husband's example of faithfulness. She left off the penances she had begun and had to endure 8 years of imprisonment, after which she was burnt alive. A second auto da fe was held in 1559 in Valladolid with Philip II present. There were 29 prisoners, of whom 16 were penitents, including 2 who were not Lutherans at all, but guilty of some other offences. One of those to be burnt was Don Carlos de Seso, a nobleman who had served Charles V. Later he served the Reformation by circulating books and teaching the true faith. When he was told a sentence, he asked for a pen, ink and paper and wrote down a confession of his faith. He said, "This is the true faith of the gospel, as opposed to that of the Church of Rome, which has been corrupted for ages. In this faith I wish to die, and in the remembrance and lively belief of the sufferings of Jesus Christ." Friars spent that night and the next morning trying to persuade him to recant, but without success. At the stake, the friars again attempted to make him confess he was wrong. He replied loudly and firmly, "I could demonstrate to you that you ruin yourselves by not imitating my example, but there is no time." He was 42. Domingo de Roxas, the pastor of Valladolid, was arrested as he tried to flee the country. He was repeatedly examined by the Inquisition, who ordered him to be tortured. He was more afraid of torture than of death, and, deceived by the prospect of a merciful sentence, he made some profession of sorrow, but was soon undeceived. Being led past the king at the auto da fe, he appealed to Philip, "Can you, sire, thus witness the torments of your innocent subjects? Save us from so cruel a death." The hard-hearted monarch replied, "No, I would myself carry wood to burn my son if he was such a wretch as you." At the beginning of the persecution of Protestants in Valladolid, a Juan Sanchez fled to the Netherlands, then under Spanish rule. From there he wrote to a Spanish lady who, unknown to him, had already been arrested as a suspected Lutheran. The letters fell into the hands of the Inquisition, and Sanchez was arrested and sent back to Valladolid. He was condemned as a heretic. When the fire had consumed the ropes which tied him to the stake, he ran, no doubt unthinkingly, onto the platform where the confessions of those who had recanted were heard. Recollecting himself, he saw on one side some prisoners on their knees doing penance. On the other side, he saw Don Carlo de Seso standing in the midst of the flames. He said, "I will die like de Seso," and walked deliberately back to the fire. He was just 32. A nun was denounced to the Inquisition. She acknowledged she had thought about some Lutheran teachings, but without realizing their meaning. She asked to be reconciled to the church, but this was refused because she persisted in claiming that she had not fully assented to these teachings. It seemed to her that they wished to put into her mind errors she was ignorant of, rather than persuade her to abandon them. She would not tell lies to save her life. She was strangled and burnt. McCree comments, "This act proclaimed that there was no safety in Spain for any who harboured a thought at variance with her Roman faith, or who was not prepared to yield the most absolute obedience to the dictates of the Inquisition." Among the prisoners brought to an auto da fe in Seville was Don Pedro Ponce de León. No one was more obviously attached to the Reformation cause. For years he avoided giving any place to superstition and tried to prepare himself for suffering by visiting the sites where others had been punished. But in the day of testing, he failed. As a member of the nobility, the inquisitors were particularly anxious to have him recant. Under torture, they had him confess some of the charges against him. With customary deceit, they persuaded him that he would not only save himself, but others, if he confessed everything. He agreed to do so, but very quickly changed his mind and was martyred. Among others she suffered were four monks from the San Isidro monastery. One of them was Garcia de Arias. After being imprisoned, these monks gave up the cautious policy that had left them still saying Mass while embracing much scriptural doctrine and practice. He explicitly confessed his faith and offered to prove the Roman beliefs highly erroneous. At his trial, he pointed out the ignorance of the inquisitors, who had been forced to admit their inability to interpret the Bible. An old man, Garcia went to the stake leaning on a staff, but the expression on his face indicated happiness. Another monk from San Isidro had followed his previous companions to Geneva, and after Elizabeth came to the English throne, was on his way back to England, along with some English exiles who had fled during the reign of Mary. At Strasbourg, he was betrayed to a spy and was arrested as he boarded a ship bound for England. Brought back to Spain, he was tortured and he developed consumption. But however weak he now was physically, he was sent to the stake. There, briefly but emphatically, he confessed the faith for which he was about to suffer. Among the women who suffered was Dona Isabel de Baena, just 20. She was well educated and so was able to read the Bible in Latin. Before the Inquisition, she avowed her faith, defended it as the ancient truth which Luther had recovered from the rubbish by which it had been hid for ages. She told her judges it was their duty to embrace it instead of punishing those who maintained it. Some clerics visited her on the night before she was to suffer. She told them plainly that she would have given up her beliefs if she had been in any doubt of them. Indeed, she was now more convinced of them because of how easily she had been able to answer the arguments of the Roman clerics who had visited her. When she was to be burnt, she looked cheerful. As she was being led to the stake, a priest asked her merely to repeat the Apostles' Creed, presumably as a sign of submission to Rome. She began to do so, but explained some of its statements in the Protestant saints. She was stopped, as it was at once strangled and burnt. Zafra was burnt in effigy at this auto da fe. That was the man that had escaped to Germany. The second great auto da fe in Seville was held in December 1560. Julian Hernandez, who had brought Bibles into Spain, was one of those who suffered. As he was brought out, he encouraged his fellow sufferers. Courage, comrades. This is the hour when we must show ourselves valiant soldiers of Jesus Christ. Let us now bear faithful testimony to his truth before men, and within a few hours we will receive the testimony of his approbation before angels. Eight women were burnt there that day, among whom was Maria Gomez, who had betrayed the congregation in Seville when suffering from a mental disorder. She had recovered and was received back by the congregation before she fell into the hands of the Inquisition. These autos da fe continued for many years. From 1560 to 1570, at least one took place each year in all 12 cities where provincial tribunals of the Spanish Inquisition had been established. At each of them, condemned Protestants appeared. In the end, the Inquisition's brutal methods were, in their own terms, successful. After 1570, the Inquisition was still discovering a few Protestants. But when 57 prisoners were brought to an auto da fe in 1654, only one was a Lutheran. And among 118 condemned at another in Madrid in 1680, only one was a Protestant, and he had already died in prison, but his effigy and bones were cast into the flames. Perhaps the fact that the church in Spain was no longer characterized by outward scandal meant that it was more difficult for the average Spaniard to recognize there was a problem with the church. Yet the main point is the sovereignty of God. When one country is taken and another is left in its superstitions, some Spaniards could practice the true religion in other lands, like the 12 former monks who reached Geneva. And there was a Spanish congregation in London from 1559. Yet, sadly, among those who fled Spain were some who denied the doctrine of the Trinity. The most famous was Michael Servetus, burnt to death by the Genevan authorities because of his heresies. We are used to hearing that the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. That was indeed so, for instance, in the early centuries of Christianity, but not in 16th century Spain. In Macri's words, persecution may be carried to such a pitch as will, without a miracle, crash the best of causes.